We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall. Welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbeam, and wherever you find your podcasts. One of the tragedies of being human is that we're wired for attachment in a world of impermanence. If we take this idea on board, which is easier said than done, how do we deal better with loss? How can we face life events like bereavement or divorce without getting stuck, bitter and angry, or burying the pain? My witness on The Meaningful Life believes the goal is to integrate the loss into our life rather than try and get over it. He is Dr. Robert Neimeyer, who is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Memphis and the director of the Portland Institute for Loss and Transition. He also has an active clinical practice too. Now, before we start unpacking the ideas in the introduction, I'd like to find out a bit about you. So what in your childhood prepared you for a career dealing with grief?
Well, I can answer that paradoxically, I think, as probably all truths can be framed paradoxically. You can affirm one or the other option with about equal legitimacy. In one sense, I was completely unprepared for dealing with grief. Certainly the grief that descended on our household with my father's suicide when I was 11 years old was not one I was prepared to take on board. Immediately, I was promoted to being the little man in the family because my mother needed a stand-in for my father and certainly needed help finding a way forward in a life landscape utterly shattered and made alien by that loss in the midst of course, a tumult of very complex emotions, of which grief was merely a part. In doing what I did to accommodate that reality, developing a kind of pseudo-maturity required to somehow contribute to our survival as a family. I suppose the response to that loss ultimately primed me for recognizing the importance of loss more generally in life. And across the course of living, that consolidated into a kind of focus of research, focus of clinical practice, and a common theme that I engage with others, whether the losses come by way of death or non-death changes that are deeply unwelcome, like the divorce that you had mentioned, Andrew.
So how did your family deal with loss? Were they ones that got stuck in it, or were they ones that tried to bury it?
Both of the above. And I think that, indeed, when people try to bury a loss rather than to exhume it and in some way take it in, find a place for it in our life narratives and our stories of who we are and who we're becoming, when we try to push it away, the one thing that we guarantee that avoidance will do is it will prevent us from mastering it. It will prevent us from befriending it. It prevents us from learning the lessons that it potentially has to teach us. And so, of course, that was an understandable response on my mother's part. Overwhelmed with her pain, within months we moved from one state in the country, Ohio, to the distant state of Florida. And in this, we lost everything and everyone else we knew, greatly compounding our isolation and our suffering. And somehow, like most bereaved people, we staggered forward in that landscape, my mother being really captured in a box of grief, arguably for the rest of the decades of her life. She responded with attempting to mitigate that pain through the use of alcohol. That gave her two problems for the price of one. And she herself made multiple serious suicide attempts in the decade that followed Dad's death, with myself and my younger brother and sister being the suicide interventionist on call. So it was a very difficult adolescence that, as I implied, primed us, my brother and myself at least, for a career in psychology. We found ourselves being drawn to that because at least it addressed in some satisfying depth the complexity of being thrown into what we came to understand years later as a psychological trauma. But at the time, I was simply looking for somebody who and some things, some literature, some curriculum study that gave us a bit of orientation to the psychosocial complexity of what we were going through.
And the problem, of course, is if you don't deal with the loss, you pass it on to the next generation to sort out, which is sort of what happened in your case, really, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't blame my mother for that. She herself was a comparatively young mother. She was left with three kids. We lost the family business, which was a pharmacy. We plunged from a middle-class existence to poverty and living on government food stamps. So at the most practical of levels, as well as at those deeply existential levels that arise when one's world suddenly just explodes, the foundation falls out from under you. When you're faced with very difficult questions of meaning, you know, what does it mean that my husband died by suicide, that he, you know, took a bottle full of barbiturates and drank a fifth of whiskey to make sure he would not awaken into another day of living? What responsibility do I, as his spouse, bear for that? What was the character of his suffering, evident enough in his own alcoholism and indirect attempts at self-destruction? What was my responsibility in meeting that pain? How did I fail? And so that whole kind of complex of guilt and anger and anguish can become quite a tangled skein of threads. Mom, of course, had no companionship in attempting to tease those out and find a through line that would carry her into a more viable life.
And the support that would possibly be available now would not have been available for her.
That's right. That's right. I remember going to a church service at a church that was not our denomination. We were raised Catholic, and this was some form of Protestant church where the pastor was giving a sermon on suicide. Some kind of a church talk. I think that was the only thing that she found that even mentioned the word suicide. And she and the coroner and others essentially promulgated the story that the dad died by heart attack, which is true enough. The barbiturates did stop his heart, but in an attempt to provide a more palatable explanation for his sudden dying, it was misrepresented. And of course, one of the tragedies that this generated is that even on the rare occasions where she would receive some kind of support, it didn't go to the heart of the matter because it went to address a form of dying that wasn't actually his. And the secret story, the loss and the grief remained only her own.
So in the introduction, I said we're wired for attachment in a world of impermanence. Now that's a quote from you. Perhaps you'd like to unpack it for me.
Yeah, I think that this is, it is a quote from me, but it might more eloquently have been phrased in Sanskrit or something by the Buddha a few thousand years ago. The reality of our human circumstances that we are wired to attach to people, places, projects, possessions, possibilities, all of which are life-defining for us. We invest ourselves in them. We cherish them. We pursue them. But ultimately, all of those same people, places, projects, possessions, possibilities are finite. They will all rise up and be a part of our life for a time. They will all fall away. Loss is the one guaranteed outcome in life. And so when we recognize that everyone and everything that we love, we will one day lose, at least in an earthly sense, then it really establishes loss as a kind of core course in the curriculum of life. It's not one that we can choose not to take. It's not an elective. And indeed, it's a course in which we'll be enrolled for the rest of our lives. So that's the gist of that quote, is underscoring the universality of this and how it has an important role to play in every life lived.
So at the moment, I'm sort of coming straight up against that particular topic because I have a dog that's 12 and a half years old and seems to have a problem that the vet can't get to the bottom of. And, you know, you're very aware of the impermanence of everything. But the problem is when you get a puppy, although you intellectually know that you're going to outlive it, you sort of put it off and you say, I'll think about that another day. And then unfortunately, another day arrives.
Sadly, it does. I also just want to dignify such losses and not diminish them. Some of the keenest grief I ever felt was when I had to make the difficult decision with my wife to put down or euthanize our dog, a similar age to yours, just a year or two older, under conditions of failure in multiple systems that could not be reversed. That was anguishing. It was tender. And it was a shared emotional journey that we made as a family as we had to euthanize our dog, Cole. I dug a hole in the backyard and we buried him several feet deep. In some way, of course, that hole almost was something I felt inside myself, a void and emptiness. And so depositing him in that and having a memorial service for him, bringing together family and others who loved him, at least validated his presence in our collective lives. And I think this is one of the many ways in which we seek to give meaning to loss. We find a place for it. We acknowledge it in the world, shared with others. We ritualize it. We find some way of wrapping our heads and hearts around something we deeply wish would not happen, but it does.
So thank you for dignifying that. And let's use that as an example for what you also say. The goal is to integrate the loss into our life. So how do you integrate a loss into your life?
Well, of course, this has many dimensions, but in a kind of quick shorthand, what I would say is that we're attempting to include it as a chapter in our life story, a significant one, sometimes a turning point chapter, as in the death of my father. And that is to say that we find a way of speaking about the loss, to the loss. We're able to negotiate it in a world shared with others who want to hear the story, who can contribute to the story, who can value the character who has been lost. In the case of a person or a pet, other losses, of course, of a relationship, of health, of a country of origin under circumstances of necessary migration, a loss of beliefs. There are losses, abstract and concrete, that are consequential. But we at least do have some rituals for negotiating the losses of such living entities as people and pets. And so that provides a measure of consolation.
And maybe for things like divorce, we sort of need a ritual to somehow end it. I have actually once been to an untying ceremony. I have to say it was a deeply uncomfortable experience to be in the audience, or not the audience, be in the, well, I suppose it wasn't a congregation, so I suppose to be present in it. I mean, I really applaud the people who did it, but it made me feel very uncomfortable.
Well, I think we need to be aware of rituals that serve the celebrant at the expense of others. Those are the perhaps natural ones to gravitate toward when we feel aggrieved by the life decision of another, which indeed can be short-sighted and even narcissistic. But we typically, when we assert our own story over against that of another with whom we are parting ways, we do a kind of violence to both. We simplify two complicated life narratives, and we also shed responsibility for reconstructing a life that is worthy of us when we've relinquished one that is not. So I don't believe that the best rituals are ones that benefit only one party to such leave-taking. I think we do better to find a path forward that is more noble than that.
So let's look at the process of integrating the loss. And I'm going to take you through the stages that you talk about. And the first one is to name and claim the experience. And you talk about it being a full body experience that you need to name and claim. So explain what you mean by that.
Well, when we are trying to make sense of loss, we're trying to do so in a couple of registers. We're trying to relearn a world that has changed fundamentally. My mother was trying to learn a new world and the state that literally the psychological state and the geographic state into which she moved as a consequence of my dad's tragic dying. And so in this sense, we're trying to learn the world once more, but we're also trying to relearn the self. Who am I now in the aftermath of this loss? Who are we as a family or as a community in the aftermath of this dying? So those questions do take us not only into the practical arrangements of, do I keep this home? What do I do with my husband's belongings? How do we now generate additional income to support the family now that, you know, the family business has ended? But beyond this, we're also trying to make sense of ourselves as well as the changed world. These troubling emotions consist of, if grief just isn't a kind of state that descends on me and then magically evaporates across the successive months, but if indeed it represents a whole tangle of issues, in this case, as I implied, and is true in nearly every case of suicide, issues of anger at the other, of guilt in relation to the self, sometimes a protest against a universe or a God, if people are religiously inclined, that permitted this to happen, the need to rework our basic assumptions about living, about predictability, about control, about, in my mother's case, being able to protect her children from the tragic reality. All of these things are deeply complicated psychological processes, and they complicate social processes as well, as people avoid bereavement in general, but they certainly avoid tragic bereavement. They don't know what to do, what to say, how to help. And so the consolation often comes in the form of, if you need anything, give me a call, and then hoping that they won't. So in this, then, I think that kind of embodied query to say, how now am I carrying my grief regarding this difficult loss? What are the pieces of it that need attention? What are the parts that I need to find words for? And with whom would I share those words? This requires a psychological and a kind of almost a somatic attention to ourselves.
And if you are able to do that, you can find the places that you're stuck, which is probably exactly where your work comes in, helping people who are stuck.
Yeah, and there are three places we tend to get stuck, Andrew, if we wanted to try to construct a little bit of a roadmap of this. We get stuck in somehow taking in, acknowledging, holding, making sense of the story of the dying itself, nowhere more than in the context of suicide or homicide or fatal accident, when we're trying to even figure out what the events were that happened and why, and who's responsible for this. But even in the course of dying as a function of illness, perhaps a long illness like cancer, just trying to figure out, what is this illness journey about, and what do I do with this diagnosis, and how do we make these treatment decisions? So all of that has to do then with somehow finding a way to integrate and navigate the story of the dying as it unfolded, as we witnessed it, or as we imagined it. In the context of violent death dying, 95% of the time we're not present to it. But that doesn't keep us from having horrific images of how it unfolded. So that's one place people get stuck. And that calls for a trauma-informed approach to care, because it is the traumatic imagery and implications of the loss that people get stuck in. And they may find themselves going over and over and over and over again, the events of the death, ruminating on them, unable to get outside that loop and to move forward. It's as if their life gets stuck on this kind of broken track of the record that keeps playing. The second place people get stuck is in terms of their relationship to the deceased, as they are typically not motivated to relinquish the relationship, to let go and move on. The primary mandate of grieving is to find a way to restore the attachment in a way that is sustainable now. We don't want to stop loving our children when they die, or our parents either, for that matter, or any other significant person. We want to still be able to speak their name, to share their story. We want to be able to cultivate a sense of psychological or spiritual closeness to them in our ongoing lives. And the difficulty in doing that arises when we confront that task with a lot of unfinished business, a lot of unresolved relational issues. Again, if we think about my mother, she had many such with my father, many conversations about what's happening here, why did this occur, who's to blame, all of the guilt, all of the regret, all of the need for forgiveness or the need to forgive, all represented, you know, a tangle of needs that were not addressed. And so people can become very stuck in that process of rebuilding, reconstructing the relationship to one that doesn't require physical presence. And the third piece, just to be brief about it, is the, if we talk about, on the one hand, we're trying to integrate the event story of the dying, we're trying to realign the relational story of our continuing bond with the other. And then the third thing is, we're trying to reinvent ourselves. We're trying to ask and answer that question, who am I now? Who are we now? So we're attempting to revise the self-narrative to say, what now is possible for me? What choices do I have and must I make that I did not face previously? And so a simple way of phrasing all that is to say that grieving is a function of who we are, who we lose, and how we lose them. And problems in any one of those domains can arise that can leave us quite stuck in knowing how to move forward in light of this tragic transition.
So the next thing you talk about is something that I have never really thought about before, and that's that you realign the relationship with the person you've lost so they become accessible resources. Now, tell me about that.
Well, I think this is commonly the case. It's so common that we may even miss it because it's hidden in plain view. That when people pass out of our lives, what remains? Partly it's going to depend on our spiritual framework. If we have a conception of some form of alternative continued existence into which people have moved, they may in some sense be accessible to us as guides of a spiritual kind. If we are of a more secular disposition and don't hold such cosmologies as that, we nonetheless can readily and easily, in some sense, access the voice and values of the other to provide orientation. I could ask myself, you know, what would my Irish grandmother, Katie Clancy, how would she handle this? Well, you know, and I could think it through. And, or I could say, you know, my dad in his more adaptive days when he was building that pharmacy from scratch and making a success of it, what kind of grit and determination did he require in order to do that? And how can some of that inform what I now face as I try to build this little business of my own? So, it's not an uncommon thing for us to attempt to draw on the life imprint of the other, right? The kind of imprint they left on the memory foam of our hearts and souls and minds to say, how can this now inform me going forward? I might have imaginal dialogues with them. Mom, what would you suggest I do about it? Oh, and of course, thanks. We construct continuity. And we do it not only in terms of those who have provided care to us, that's that attachment bond that we were talking about, but also those to whom, for whom we are the attachment figure, such as our children. I've yet to meet a bereaved parent who doesn't want to continue to love that child, who doesn't want to continue to tell that child's stories, to share the photographs, to hang a Christmas ornament on the tree in, you know, that was a special one given to that child or from that child, maybe something they made in school. And so this is in some way a perfectly natural thing to ask, how do we continue a bond? How do we realign it, reconstruct it, rather than relinquish it as the most adaptive course through grieving? I will say as a footnote that when relationships are very abusive and destructive, that sometimes we really do have to say goodbye to the problematic figure. But more commonly, we're looking for a way to say hello again.
So one of the things you do in your sessions is you help people have an imaginal dialogue for unfinished business. It's something I do myself. I have a magic chair, which actually used to belong to my grandfather, that I bring from the office part of my counseling room into the therapy part. And we place the imaginal person. I mean, sometimes these people are still alive, but often, you know, they can equally be dead. And what is really strange is that sometimes you can actually feel their presence because of just what the other person is bringing with them. It sounds very weird, but you're nodding your head. You understand.
Oh,
that.
I'm having shivers up my spine as you say this. I feel it vicariously as you just invoke that scene, because, of course, I've lived it myself with so many clients. And I think in my own personal experience, where I can sense my mother's presence in some way with me. And I have a somatic feel that she's affirming certain questions I'm putting to her. And so I'm a constructivist, meaning I see us as always constructing and reconstructing a world of meaning. We kind of make it up as we go along. I don't know about the ontological status of a spiritual realm, meaning is it something that's really out there and am I tapping into conversations with the dead? But what I do know that as a psychologist and as a person, anything that is experienced as real is real in its consequences. And so when you or I have the astonishing honor of sitting in the presence of someone who is reaching into the deepest wells of grief or concern or anguish, and doing so also reach out to someone who can potentially help them with that. And it might be someone with whom they need to resolve a really problematic issue. It might be someone whose support would mean the world to them. As they experience that exchange as something very real and tangible, then you and I also do. And that's an incredible resource to work with when the pain that we're experiencing is also in relation to that same person. And so why would we not then invoke that person's presence as a potential ally in addressing the pain?
And the next thing is retell the tales of loss, but do it without traumatizing or re-traumatizing. Because you really do need to have the story. I mean, your mother's version of the story was not a coherent narrative. And in a sense, that's what you've got to put together on two fronts. One, you know, because the topic comes up and you need a sort of a one-line sort of kind of explanation, but you also need a deeper one that you tell yourself.
That's very well said, Andrew. I should talk with you more often. I would be a better therapist for doing so. I think people do have both needs. We need to have the abstract of the story or the Reader's Digest version, the kind of summary statement, you know, that conveys a complex story in simple terms. We need that just to navigate social life. But also, there can be enormous liberation in finding at least a select audience in therapy or beyond it, in our families, or in our social networks and worlds, for the unexpurgated, uncensored version of the story, where even the hard bits can find expression. And to construct a safe place, a kind of secure base relationship, as your countryman John Bowlby would once have called it, or Donald Winnicott, another fine therapist and psychiatrist, talking about building a holding environment in therapy or counseling, where a place that can safely contain difficult emotions, difficult experiences, difficult stories, then we invite people to slowly unfold the story as it occurred, backing back and forth between the external events. We got this phone call, and there was an official-sounding voice on the other end saying, you need to come down to the hospital immediately. Your father won't be with us long. And from the very point of death notification or when the person begins to take a downturn, people have a variety of experiences, a kaleidoscope of them that they're trying to fit together into meaningful patterns and say, what happened next? And in addition to sequencing the story, finding ways to tell what happened to us, we also need to be able to tell not only that external story, but the internal story. What was triggered in us at that moment? What feeling arose for me? You say you went nearly numb, Andrew. What did that numbness feel like? It's like my ears were buzzing. I couldn't even hear what the person on the other end was saying. What was happening in your body? I found myself like almost frozen. I was just breathing very shallowly, and I wasn't even aware. I guess my partner was still in the room, but I don't even know. It's like I just felt like I was in a black hole. So we find ways of folding in the personal story with that kind of external one. And then we look for the threads of meaning. What sense did you make of what was happening at that point? How did that change as it evolved as you went to the hospital? What did you discover? And so we're really braiding three narrative strands, the external, the internal, the meaning-oriented, to try to help people put together what you described as a more coherent story. And we do it slowly. We do it with assistance as people need to regulate very difficult emotions in the midst of that. Just as you walk in the room and I can hear the break in your voice and I can see the tears in your eyes, could we just sit with this scene for a moment, Andrew? Just breathe with me slowly, taking a deep breath, holding it, releasing it slowly, and without leaving that room in which your father is lying in that bed.
And it's amazing how often people want to interrupt you when you're, even at the very beginning when you're telling the story, you have a deep need to tell it, and they want to try and make it better, so they try and rush you through it. And that is really annoying.
It is really annoying, and it really produces two outcomes, or three. Well, I mean, the third outcome is that it allows them to get out of the uncomfortable story as quickly as possible, under the misguided assumption that they're helping you do the same. But it also, of course, has the possible effect of re-traumatizing you, because it's like you've moved into that space and you have no accompaniment in it. They're abandoning you in that place. Or you comply and you move forward through the story superficially and nothing changes. It's the same story you've told 100 times. It hasn't helped the first 99. Why would it help the 100th? So what you need is someone who can stand with you slowly in the story. Not can you rush to the end, but can you tell me more about that, Andrew? When you looked at your father's face and he looked at you with those eyes, what did you see in those eyes? I saw fear, Bob. Fear of dying, I imagine. He couldn't speak anymore, but he looked like a scared child. And what arose in you as you saw that childlike fear in his eyes? Just wanted to hold him. And did you? Yes. Yeah. I gathered him up, his frail body in my arms, and I just held him. And were there words that filled those moments, Andrew? I just said again and again, I love you, Dad. I love you. So this would be an example of, you know, a micro moment, a few minutes of such telling where we're not trying to get through the story. We're trying to drill down into the story. We're giving the person the space that the world rarely gives to tell the full story that includes them as a protagonist and not merely as a co-victim of the story.
And then the final one is you need to look at your life goals and redefine them.
That's right. Because when we experience a landmark event in life, we can't just cut it out and throw it away and censor it. We make decisions in light of that. We enact relationships differently because of it. We may recruit new relationships. We revise our life goals and roles in light of that. Every death in the family shifts the whole family system. Not only in the case of my being promoted to being a kind of surrogate parent or adult at the age of 11 or 12, but in every family, the roles occupied by that person need to be filled. Who's going to cook dinner now that mom, who's always done it, is not here? Or who's going to be the breadwinner? Maybe she was the main source of employment, and now we have practical problems to solve. And so at levels practical as well as existential, we have to ask this question of who am I now? Whose am I now? And how am I going to move forward with this life?
Because I find as a couple therapist, often what will be the precipitating thing that will get a couple into coming to see me will be one of them is sat at the deathbed of their parents. I mean, we all intellectually know it, but there's nothing more sort of emotionally resonant than actually sitting there and being with them and knowing that life is not forever. And then if you've only got X amount of time, do you want to live it in the way that you're living it now? I mean, that's a really important question.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, these are the kinds of questions that Martin Heidegger and the existentialists world prompted us to face nearly 100 years ago in the history of philosophy. When we look at life with death as a part of it, and we do so unflinchingly, then it is a real values clarification exercise. What do I want to make of this limited life that is mine? How can I give it meaning and value? So this will often, you know, force us to do a kind of truth-telling about what really matters to us, who matters to us. And, you know, good things can come from that. These are maybe some of the positive lessons of loss.
Now, you have a great question when you ask when you're working with a client, and it's one I actually stole myself this week as well. And I think it's a good one for everyone facing loss at this precise moment. And that question is, what do I need deeply at this moment?
Yeah, I think that this and the tandem question, what am I ready for at this moment?
Oh, that's a good one.
Provide an absolute crosshairs, a sighting instrument for what we need to be attending to in therapy and in life. So as a therapist, I am at every moment of my interaction with the client asking the question, what is Andrew's deepest need right now at this moment in his evolution as a being struggling with the kind of suffering he brought in here? What does he need right now in connection with that? And not just like in this session, but in this moment of the session, what is he needing? And what's he ready for in connection with that need? Those are two different questions. You might be, for example, deeply lonely in the aftermath of the death of your partner 3 years ago, but you might not be at all ready to begin to consider another relationship. So where need and readiness meet, you know, where Need Avenue crosses Readiness Road, you can go in a lot of useful directions in therapy. But if you don't arrive at where the client is, you can't go anywhere. Therapy begins with where the client is, not with where we are as therapists. And so I think that direction-finding device is really crucial at each moment of therapy.
So we're going to ask that question, what do I need deeply at this moment? And possibly, what am I ready for in just a moment with a letter that's been written in to us?
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
So, if you'd like to participate in The Meaningful Life, write us a letter, or you want to become a supporter, join our newsletter and get into your inbox articles from me, go to www.andrewgmarshall.com and go to podcasts and participate in the show. My husband and I decided to separate and are filing for divorce soon. I've lost complete hope for saving my marriage after my husband's affair, as he admitted to texting the other woman yet again. I've accepted that he's on his journey, and I can only control my own narrative, thought, and actions. I've been fighting for our marriage and tried so hard to convince him that we can have that sexual spark. He was pessimistic. He admitted he felt that he would never feel the same way he did towards the other woman with me. We have very different memories of our early days together. I started to doubt myself and my memories. I come from a very traditional background, and throughout the years, especially after becoming a mother and a leader in a specialist role, I've embodied a personal abandoning my sexual side altogether. I'm finding hurt again. My question is, what other steps can I take to heal from the affair, my inner wounds, etc.? I've been looking after myself better. I've lost weight. I'm meditating, nurturing friendships, reading, breathing.
Well, I find this to be a very inspiring letter. I take it as a kind of turning point missive for her. She's beginning to relinquish a kind of fantasy bond, if you will, that she cultivated in connection with her husband, really began to reinterpret the history of the relationship, and to do so in ways that potentially are very liberating for her to find a life that is legitimately hers now. The fact that she's doing it so affirmatively, taking care of her body, taking care of her metaphorical heart in terms of the possible rediscovery of her sexual self and the possibilities that opens for new relations, to take into account practices of self-care, the weight loss, the meditation, the the nurturing of relationships that can nurture her in return, private practices, reading, breathing, all of these feel very progressive to me. And so I actually I do have a few things that I would offer to her by way of affirmation. And one is that she speaks about accepting that this has been the case. And I think that is so important to be able to do and to recognize that acceptance does not mean approval. She may deeply regret her husband's behavior, his choices, but what acceptance means is acknowledgement. Yes, that really happened. And this really is not a recoverable dalliance.
I love that. Acceptance does not mean approval.
It means acknowledgement.
And how do you deal with somebody else rewriting your history?
Well, we have to take that as a given in human life. We are not the sole narrators and readers of our story. We solicit their help all along in writing those stories to begin with. And so we shouldn't be surprised if they also have a hand in unwriting them and erasing some of the lines that they themselves had helped write, as in the experience of both the formation of a relationship, perhaps it was a bond that yielded children and families and melded families, but all of those players that have a hand in the continuance of that story or in its discontinuance. And so I think that we have to acknowledge that when we have many co-authors, we have many people who may be editing the script. Nonetheless, once we have parted with those co-authors, then just as she said very beautifully, only I can control my narrative, thoughts, and actions. Now she becomes the author of that story, and we are all entitled to the story of our lives, so we may as well make it a good one.
And I think that that would be one of the things I would say. I'm sort of feeling a little bit, she doesn't feel entirely entitled to her version of the story, and she's still feeling that she's got to take his edits in. And ultimately, it's your story. Your view is going to be different from his, and that's okay. One of the great advantages of separating from somebody is you no longer have to integrate their version of the story into your shared version, because there is no shared version. Your version is just as valid as his, and when you're telling it, it is the truth.
Yes, I think that's a very important point and one that I would underscore as well. It bears on one of the things that I hold to be a principle of truth in life. But I also think that if we wish for other people to understand credulously and compassionately our stories, then we owe it to them to do the same with theirs. So that I don't think that a kind of discourse of, you know, one person winning and one losing is the optimal outcome, whether it's in a political contest or whether it's in a divorce circumstance. We're better off looking for ways that stories can complement one another. We can look for the grain of truth in each. We can understand the other as an author of a life story that has its own integrity. And so how do we allow these stories to stand side by side or possibly even to fit together as parts of a larger puzzle?
So you ask, what other steps can you take? And obviously we've got to answer those two questions. What do I want deeply at this moment? And also, what am I ready for? But I think when you've had loss, you need to bring something new into the picture. Now, I've had clients that their new was learning the ukulele, for example, and joining a ukulele orchestra, which, as you can imagine, brought laughter and fun and new people into this client's world. It could be that, you know, you want to climb a mountain. It could be that you want to do a poetry class. Ask yourself the question, what have I always wanted to do, but up to now I haven't had enough time to do? Because the one thing about a relationship is it takes up an awful lot of time, and suddenly you've got all this extra time. And maybe you might need to go all the way back to your childhood to find some of these things that you always wanted to do. You know, if you wanted to dance, well, now is the time to get your dancing shoes on, so to speak. What new thing can you bring in? Because you've got this extra time. Let's take advantage of it.
I think that that's well said. Adaptive grieving is not just a process of dealing with tumultuous emotion, though it is that too. It is also, as we say, relearning the world. Some friends of mine, Maggie Strobe and Henk Schut in the Netherlands, offer what they call the dual process model of grieving. And one process is what they call all those loss processes. How do I handle my grief? But then there's also the restoration processes. How do I get on with my life? And what do I need to replace? What do I need to reinvent? As well as what do I need to renew? So there may be aspects of the old world, of course, that we cherish and we find ways to carry forward. But we will indeed encounter many opportunities to embrace the new. And your delightful list is an illustration of that.
And what is also nice, and I know this from personal experience, is that sometimes it's sort of rather nice to meet people for whom you're just you. You're not a widower, for example, who are actually thinking and know that it is you plus one, and you know the plus one isn't here. You know, you're just you, and they have you have no history beyond the fact that you like the ukulele too, sort of kind of thing.
This can be almost terrifyingly or exhilaratingly the case when we recognize that these new relations that we're cultivating aren't looking at us through the lens of history. If they are, it's their history, not our own, because they don't know that. I can make fundamental changes in who I am and what I do, or I can make modest evolutions in it. The change can be evolutionary or revolutionary, and that can be very liberating.
I hope that is helpful for you. We're coming towards the end of the main part of the program. So I need to ask you as a witness on the meaningful life, and this is obviously a question you are asking your clients as well. What makes your life meaningful?
Love would be high on that list. The love of my partner, most specifically. She brings great joy to my life and great purpose. Of my grown children. But I find that my love does extend pretty extensively to humanity as a whole. I love moments of encounter with strangers in which connections can be found and forged and developed. And I find that the purposes that I pursue, even in isolation, ultimately feed into and contribute to that world. I like to write. I like to do therapy. That's deeply meaningful for me. I love to watch people transform their lives too. Release or at least repurpose their suffering in a way that allows them to renew their being. So there's so much in life that gives me meaning, engagement in the natural world as well as the human world and the built environment. I have many anchors, I suppose, moving forward.
It's interesting you talk about anchors, because what I want to talk about in the bonus material is how to create a safe base for recovery from loss and other setbacks in life. And if you'd like to hear the bonus material, you can subscribe directly via Apple or Spotify. And if you want to become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and unlock the bonus material this way, here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.